The table audio is made possible by the generous support of the John Templeton Foundation and the Templeton Religion Trust.
So for me, this in spite of love, because of love, alongside of love is a way to think about general ways in which love as an overarching word is expressed in our lives day to day.
You know, love is this mysterious thing.
Yeah.
You know, she moves in mysterious ways.
Thank you, Bono.
I'm Evan Rosa, and you're listening to The Table Audio, a podcast about seeking Christian wisdom for life's big questions. What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. What's love got to do with it? This is an episode about love, the definition of love, the mystery of love, the power of love. It's also an episode with some song title puns in it. Really, though, for something so familiar to human experience, love is notoriously difficult to define, to put your finger on, to explain and articulate. It's even harder to embody, of course. We all seem to acknowledge that love is somewhere near the center of life's meaning. And as philosopher and activist for the mentally disabled Jean Vanier says, we are all born and we all die with the same primal searching cry. Do you love me? My guest in this episode of The Table, Thomas J. Ord, has spent the last two decades thinking about the theology, science, and philosophy of love. He's authored and edited over 20 books, including Science of Love, The Wisdom of Well-Being, The Altruism Reader, Selections from Writing on Love, Religion, and Science, Defining Love, A Philosophical, Scientific, and Theological Engagement, and The Nature of Love, A Theology. He also incidentally wrote a book for philosophers and theologians that actively use social media. That's pretty interesting too. In this conversation, we cover a variety of themes and questions related to the theology of love, including love's definition and expression, the nature of divine love, the connection between love and fear, and a Christian understanding of the science and psychology of love. And sorry, you knew it was coming. I want to know what love is. I want you to show me. Enjoy. It's all right.
Thomas J. Ord. I go by Tom most of the time. Mm-hmm. Married. I'm a husband. I'm a father. I'm a Christian. I'm a professor. I'm a, how about this? I'm an ideas entrepreneur.
Oh. A man in the business of ideas.
That's right. Yeah. I like to think about and try to encourage people to think about the big issues of life, the big questions. Oh. And not just think about the questions, but I want to propose answers I think are more plausible or more helpful. So asking questions is important. Looking for answers that I think are reasonable, make a difference in a positive way. Since I'm a Christian, those that align, I think, well with the Christian tradition, scripture, et cetera, those are important to me.
Yeah. In the scheme of questions and answers, some people, and maybe some people more on the cynical side, they like to sort of question the answers, right? And say, well, I don't really know, you know?
Yeah.
It's more about the questions. Where do you fall in terms of...
I feel like you can lean too far either way. You know, obviously some people think they've got all the answers and they don't want anybody questioning the answers they have, and even those answers that they think are the core of the Christian tradition. Other people are just don't seem to want answers. They just want to be questioning all the time. Yeah. So I think it's important to pursue both. I get a little nervous when, especially people in my tradition, the Christian tradition, have sort of some sacred ideas that they won't question at all. On the other hand, you know, obviously some of those ideas are there because they've been thought through and people think these are the best options on the table. And so they're worth trying to protect, trying to defend, and trying to propose reasons why they're the best.
Yeah. I heard a recent distinction between creativity and intelligence and was intrigued by that. Then I also read something of yours where you talk about, this was just a blog post, I think, but it was creativity when it comes to theology, philosophy, and a search after the truth. So what is creativity in this pursuit of theology and seeking truth and spiritual reality?
Yeah, I think creativity is never ex nihilo, never just sort of tries to operate without any materials whatsoever. Creativity always builds upon things and draws from and reorganizes. But it also, creativity looks for novelty, new possibilities, new opportunities, things that might make better sense. And I think Christians are especially called to pursue those kinds of novelty, because I think God, I'm Pentecostal enough to think God is doing a new thing. And so when God does a new thing, there's new words and ways to think about that and talk about that in the world.
Yeah. That worries some people.
Yeah.
Creativity worries people because it represents, well, new things worry people, right?
Yeah.
How have you managed being in the business of ideas, but being a creative in that world? Clearly you have a big heart for the audience that you're trying to reach. You care so deeply about the ideas that you're working on, but you care about the people who you're in conversation with. I see that.
I do care a great deal.
How do you manage the worry, their worry, I should
yeah.
say?
Well, maybe I don't always manage it well, because sometimes their worries, put me in difficult situations and cause pain. I think I'm more of a risk taker than most people, because I have this really deep sense that God loves me and God loves everyone. And I want to be a person who expresses that love and the way I act, et cetera. And so a lot of people who don't agree with my proposals, who hang around me long enough, realize that I really do care about them. And I care about what I think God is doing in the world. And even if we disagree on some of the ideas that I'm proposing, we can agree. John Wesley has this great sermon in which he talks about this idea that, give me your hand, because our hearts are in the same place. And we may not think alike, but we can love alike. And that's kind of a motto in my life.
One of your other mottos is associated with your blog, right? For the love of wisdom.
Yeah, and the wisdom,
Of love.
Yeah.
Where did that come from? Where is that? Because that feels like it's tied in.
It is. I mean, for me, the issues of love are at the center of how I think about the world, my work, my personal, my professional life. But that word love in today's world is such a fluffy word for a lot of people. It's a sentimentalized, it's used in so many different ways. And frankly, in the scholarly domain, a lot of people don't take it very seriously. So talking about the wisdom of love, in my view, brings in the intellectual aspect, brings in the rigor of true scholarship. And that's been a part of my goal, not only professionally, but also in just the way I live my life.
I want to talk about that and the connections between, thinking about this particular topic. I mean, the issues that you've addressed in your life, I mean, you are honest about the ways in which you attempt to internalize them. At least that's what I pick up in your work.
I try to
your
be,
work.
Yeah, I really try.
But let's hone in on the fluffiness of love and just talk about definition around that. So you've written defining love, you've written the nature of love. You've thought a lot about what love is. And I think it doesn't take much to sort of realize, you said fluffy and sentimentalized, but people really come to blows about what love is, especially once you sort of trace the way we legislate around love, the way we try to create or control the environment in which love is legitimate. So it strikes a chord with people who care about romance, who care about relationships with others, who care about or who just have needs. Can you articulate, I guess, the problem around defining love a little bit more? It's fluffy, it's sentimental, but why is it the kind of thing that just seems to evade definition?
I think there's an interesting relationship between the word love and the word God. You know, in the Christian tradition, we have that classic phrase, God is love. But what I mean here is that people disagree about what God means, and they're all over the map on that one. And so the same is true of love. What love means, people are all over the map. And it's not just one of those words like tomato sauce that people can sort of just say, well, okay, I think I know what that is, but it's not that important. this is at the core of a lot of people's view of reality, of themselves, of what they think matters. And so people are going to be sometimes testy and fight a little bit on this issue. I think, too, love and God, love is the kind of word that has many aspects and dimensions that a person can describe rightfully or truthfully and yet not capture everything you want to say about love. For instance, love has a desiring or intentional element. And a big part of the Christian tradition have equated love with desire. But I don't think love is entirely desire. It's got to be more than that. Or, you know, for my own part, I want to emphasize the aspect of love that talks about well-being or goodness, doing good. But a person can do good unintentionally, and I wouldn't call that an act of love. So there's all these elements of understanding love well that have partial truths to them. And in my view, it's trying to work at all these partial truths and bring them together to get all the dimensions together to get a more robust and complete view of love. That's fun. That's challenging. That's exciting to me.
And there's still a lot of space to explore.
Oh, definitely. No one ever gets it perfect, right?
Yeah.
But I do think we can make progress. I do think you can come to ways of thinking about love that are more helpful overall than some of the alternatives.
And so you've got a definition that you work from.
Yeah.
So I've gotten it, but I wonder if you must know it by now. How do you define what is love?
Well, I think about love as the definition is basically having three parts. The first part says love is to act intentionally. So there's some kind of intentionality, some kind of motive. And it's not just passé, you do something. Now that doing can be anything from thinking to, you know, acting in a physical way. But there's some intentionality to it. But that intention, says the second part of the definition, is always in relationship. So it's in sympathetic or empathetic response to others. And as someone who believes in God and someone who thinks that God is the source of love, the others include God. Some people will talk about love and they'll only talk about God, and they won't bring in the community of relationships we have with others in our environment. Other people, of course, don't believe in God, so they don't bring God into the discussion. For me, that second aspect of the definition of love includes these relationships that are essential to the process of loving. And then the third aspect of my definition talks about promoting overall well-being. So it's talking about doing what's good for the whole, for the common good. Mm-hmm. So to love is to act intentionally in a sympathetic response to God and others to promote overall well-being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in the space of others' definitions, or if not definitions, others' systems, right? You've got the Four Loves by C.S. Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Walter Storff's, you know, philosophical sort of like analysis of the three different kinds of love. Is there one love, or are there many different kinds of love that each ought to get their own definition?
Yeah, great question. The way I look at it is this: love has one definition, but many forms. So if an activity is truly loving, it must fit the general definition, but there are lots of different ways in which we can love, right? And we talk about compassionate love. We talk about, in the classic tradition, we talk about agape, philia, eros, but there's other forms of love like being merciful or being joyful in the presence of others. This, when I tuck my kids into bed at night, I read them a story, I kiss them, I have this sort of warm affection kind of love that acts for their well-being, but there's a great deal of positive emotional feeling involved mm-hmm. in that.
Yeah.
And that positive emotional feeling is not usually there when I'm showing love to someone who hurts me, who wrongs me, when I'm turning the other cheek. And so love has one definition, as I think of it, but many, many different forms. When we talk about love and having a general definition, as I mentioned, I think there's different forms of love. And in the Christian tradition, many Christians have highlighted this word agape. I don't think agape has the precise meaning in Scripture that many people think it does. I think agape has many different meanings. But over time, I've kind of tried to hammer out ways of thinking about agape and then also eros and philia that makes sense to me and other people found helpful. Mm. So when I think about agape, I think of the kind of love that turns the other cheek, that repays evil with good. I like to call it in spite of love. In spite of what you do to me, I am going to do something good to you. Hmm. Whereas eros in popular culture, eros means something like romance or sex, but in classic language—
or eroticism.
Your eroticism, yeah. In classic thought, eros is basically desire, some allure for the valuable, et cetera. Hmm. And I like to think of that, to use more common language, as because of love. I love you because of something valuable I find in you. And I regret that so many Christians think that that's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. I love my wife for a number of reasons, but for one of them is I think she's hot. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. And there's things about her I find particularly valuable.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes she does things that I don't like, and I have to use the agape in spite of love. But there's also things that I found about her that I love in the sense of finding them extremely valuable, and that's because of love.
Yeah.
And then that third one, phileia, I call it alongside of love, that this solidarity, this relationship, this working together to do what's good in the world. So for me, this in spite of love, because of love, alongside of love is a way to think about general ways in which love as an overarching word is expressed in our lives day to day.
You know, love is this mysterious thing.
Yeah.
You know, she moves in mysterious ways.
Thank you, Bono.
We could riff on love songs all
we
day.
We could. Well, you know, I can't remember what anniversary it was, Rolling Stone's 75th anniversary or whatever, they did this, the top 100 rock and roll songs of all time. And in that, they asked the question, what word appears most in song titles of the top 100 or 1,000 or whatever? And love, far and away, is the most frequently used word in song titles. Now, some people will say, well, that's just romantic love or sexual love. And in some cases, it probably is. But in others, it's, you know, U2's got a lot of songs about love that aren't strictly about romance and sex.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So love's a powerful thing, not only in the Christian tradition, but also in pop culture and general culture more generally.
All you need is love.
That's right.
I wonder if this is part of, I guess, the puzzle of it, the mystery of love, is that when you look at these individual expressions, it is mysterious how they might all trace back to one source or one definition.
Yeah.
Because of, I guess what I want to say is that what appears to me to be the radically different nature of loving your enemy and loving your child.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, what unites them, well, there's three things. I already mentioned them: intentionality, relationship, and well-being. But the thing that my mind goes to most quickly when I see an activity and I ask myself, is that a loving activity? What goes to my mind goes to most quickly is the issue of, is that in some way promoting what is good, what is helpful, well-being?
Well-being.
And so turning the other cheek in relation to an enemy or loving my kid, I say, is it promoting well-being? There are some instances in which people do things that we might typically say are loving, but they don't promote overall well-being. And so I would label them as loving. For instance, well, let's talk about sex, one of my favorite subjects, right?
I mean, you and many other people.
That's right. Sexual intercourse can be an incredibly loving activity because it promotes the well-being of the couple involved and, in fact, by extension, the greater community.
Yeah.
But we also know that there's some sex that doesn't promote well-being. And so sex itself isn't an act of love. You have to ask the question, is this sexual activity promoting well-being in the overall sense? And so that's the question that I bring to any sort of question of, is that activity or is that project or is what those folks are doing, is that loving? I say, well, is it promoting well-being? Now, that brings another question to the issue, and that is, how do you know if it promotes overall well-being?
Yeah, you need some standard.
Right.
To
and for philosophers, that's the epistemic question. That's the question of knowledge.
Right.
And that's one no one can know with absolute certainty unless they know all things. Since I'm one who believes in God, I think God knows all things, but I don't have crystal clear, unambiguous access to God's mind. So I, like everybody else, have to make some kind of assessment. And in doing that well, I will want to look at a variety of different features of what's going on, evaluations. I'll want to ask my community. I want to look at the traditions that I think are helpful. And then I'll try to make a judgment on whether or not this particular act promotes overall well-being. Now, most of the time, I make a quick judgment, right? I don't like think through very carefully. But yeah, sometimes it's, you know, I do want to take the bigger view.
That reminds me, I guess, of, I mean, there appears to be a little analog there to like happiness. You know, like most people are going to think that some sort of robust happiness, a flourishing, you know, yes, eudaimonia, kind of the good life,
yeah,
is the goal of life. But just the expression of that is going to change.
Exactly.
Some people see it as pleasure. Other people see it as living in accordance with nature, or you know, your human nature, a more virtue, ethical approach.
Yep.
This is all in the context of talking about how there's these different, what appears to be radically different produces, I think, an anxiety in people when it comes to people who are genuinely trying to live a loving life, mm-hmm, and wanting that for themselves and wanting to promote love in their community, whether that's a church community or a local community or a neighborhood or a family, mm-hmm, or even, I guess, even at a broader level. It's just, it's, there can be this definition of love, but when it comes to sort of acting out that definition, or in the moment, making a determination, like you said, you know, sometimes the judgment is so quick, or maybe it's not quick. Maybe it's just like you're trying to build habits for yourself for what loving action in a communal environment looks like. And I think there's some anxiety around, have I loved in this scenario? Yeah. Like, especially when there is harm, when there is a need for forgiveness, mm-hmm, a need for justice. Mm-hmm. And that the mysterious nature of love all of a sudden introduces some existential anxiety.
Definitely. Yeah. And people handle that differently. You know, people who are more prone to self-doubt are probably going to be sometimes paralyzed in the assessment of whether or not what they're doing is a loving thing. Mm-hmm. People who have a little more robust sense of self and they're saying, you know, I usually make the right options or choices, they're going to be less, you know, concerned with thinking about that. Mm. But no one, in my view, except God, no one can know with absolute certainty whether or not their actions have promoted overall well-being. But we can make some fair assessments and judgments, and oftentimes we can have a sense of whether or not what we're doing is for the good of all or some sort of extremely selfish sort of thing.
So how would you think of well-being? I mean, I've read a little bit about, you know, you speaking of it in terms of shalom.
Yes, I like that word a lot.
So can we
blessedness,
let's talk
abundant
about,
life.
How would you unpack that, connecting love to shalom?
Well, as I think of shalom, I think of, you know, we usually translate that word peace. It's more than the absence of conflict. It's this idea that there's goodness and flourishing in all kinds of dimensions of life. We use these words like eudaimonia in the philosophical tradition or in the Christian tradition, being a blessing. We use these words and they're general words to try to cover a whole variety of different forms. And so the individual or the church who wants to help those with in need are acting in ways that produce shalom, produce peace. But the individual in the church that's trying to act for justice, let's say for the environment, they're also acting in terms of peace and shalom and love. So all these different activities can all function well under the bigger categories of blessedness and shalom and eudaimonia and genuine happiness and flourishing.
Yeah. Because it's so many dimensions, shalom and the life of shalom and is sort of, it becomes complex.
Definitely.
And really nuanced.
Yes.
Can you describe some of the ways in which, even if you can sort of think of particular stories that exemplify, I guess, the ways that are maybe grand, but maybe just simple and more mundane,
yeah,
that shalom can be expressed in a community?
You know, I think a good way to answer this, I have taught a class at my university on love. And for the last 6 or 8 years, I've required students to do what I call an extra mile love project. And I talk about this idea of, it's a philosophical notion of supererogation, which is basically the idea that is you stretch yourself, you go further than what you would normally expect of yourself. And these students then have to dream up these projects that are going to push themselves. And obviously, every individual is different because what's more difficult for one person may not be difficult for another person. But it's fascinating to hear, to read then the stories the students tell about all the things they've done. So one student decided that on campus, people needed to get from one end of the campus to the other better. So he bought a bunch of used bikes and put them out there and made them, you know, you could go around campus free on these junky bikes.
Nice.
Another student frequents a particular gas station often on his way to campus, and he decided just on a whim he was going to clean that gas station completely, make it, you know, very clean, and not tell anybody why he was doing it. And of course, the manager found him after he cleaned it and was like asking the question, what are you doing here? You know, what's this all about? One woman whose, I think it was a sister, suffered from a very rare congenital disease, set up a website for parents of kids who have this disease to talk about their experiences, to have a chat room. Other students have bought groceries for those in need. One woman began a pen pal relationship with some soldiers to encourage them. I mean, it's just fascinating what people can think of in terms of helping out and doing something good for others if they're challenged to stretch themselves a little bit more. I could go on and on in all these illustrations,
sure,
but
yeah.
Hopefully that gives you a little taste of the diversity of love in the world.
Yeah, it feels sort of like random acts of kindness.
Yeah, yeah. They're not quite random because they're planned, but they're different. They're unusual. They're stretching. In sports, we sometimes talk about going to the next level.
Yeah.
This is pushing yourselves to the next level in terms of love. Yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't be random because on your definition, it has to be intentional.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
We end up paying a lot of attention to being nice, having manners, being civil, being kind. But those sometimes feel like they are soft and really don't express, I guess, the deeper vision of Jesus' love commands.
Yeah.
Can you comment on that, sort of our cultural attentiveness to sort of the surface level loving character?
Yeah.
And contrast that with a Christian vision of love?
Well, I think kindness is one aspect and one form and one expression of love. Some people develop habits of kindness that we didn't take for granted. I have a friend who's a pastor of a church, and he says, you know, these people are not motivated to get out there and doing something radical for Jesus. They're just kind and happy to each other. And I thought to myself, there are some pastors who would love just to have a kind and happy congregation.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's also these times in which I think kindness in and of itself isn't enough, that we have to take difficult stands, say things that make people uncomfortable, and do things, again, for the common good, for overall well-being, that go beyond the usual niceness that we want to express in the world. And I find that oftentimes younger people are more willing to take those kind of radical stands. I'm not quite sure why that is, but I think it's oftentimes inspirational that folks step out and do something that may make others uncomfortable, but they do it because they want to do what's right for the whole. I think in the Christian tradition, the folks who exemplify that particularly well are the prophets. Right? They stand up and they say, okay, this might not feel comfortable to you, it may not seem nice, but in order for the common good to be promoted, we've got to change. This community is screwing up. We need to act differently. Thus saith the Lord.
Stay tuned. After the break, Tom Ord and I discuss the integration of theology and science with respect to love, altruism, and character. Tom quotes The Princess Bride. We ponder the nature of God's love and the importance of social involvement and vulnerability. We talked about a lot you don't want to miss. You might even say, we did it all for the glory of love. Stay tuned. Listeners, we love you. Thanks for playing the table audio on your commute, in the kitchen, while you budget or do data entry at work, wherever, however you listen. This podcast is actually just one of the many resources we offer through Biola University's Center for Christian Thought. We also have a big library of event videos, including a talk from this episode's guest, Thomas Ord, with a more rigorous and structured presentation on defining the concept of love. So if you're hungry for more, that event video and many, many more lectures and talks are available on our website and YouTube channel. And really, the best way to get into that content is to subscribe to our email list. It's free to sign up. We send regular emails with no spam, just the goodies that you signed up for. Really thoughtful Christian scholars offering valuable insights about life's biggest questions. So head over to the homepage, cct.biola.edu, and sign up for the table and add some wisdom to your inbox. Now, back for more on everyone's favorite thing, love.
From a theologian's perspective, you know, what benefit we can receive from the science of love.
Okay.
So all sorts of sociological and biological research being done on pro-social behavior, empathy, emotion regulation, altruism. What stands out to you as profitable research that, one, helps us understand love, but two, helps us become more loving?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of what's going on in the sciences these days in terms of the questions of altruism, pro-social behavior, those empathy studies, et cetera. I'm a big fan because I think that we've too often studied the things that are not so good in the world and become experts in the malsocial practices.
Pathology.
Yeah, pathologies, yes. And not thought so much about what's right, and then also about what we might do to expand or enhance or improve upon or live out what's right. Mm. You know, some of the sciences, like for instance in biology, most of the biologists aren't thinking in terms of what these things might say about how we could become a better society. They're asking the questions of, you know, the activities and actions they see at various species and various groups, et cetera, and how can we explain them? I think those are important for us because I think part of the Christian's calling is to try to understand something about the world in which God has created, not just simply for the sake of understanding, but I really think that they can tell us something about who God is. I'm enough of a believer in Romans 1 that talks about, you know, you're looking at the world and you can find out something about God's invisible attributes by the created world. So I'm a big fan of that. I think also, you know, we have to bring in some other aspects, other disciplines other than the sciences to make things especially fruitful. You know, as a philosopher and a theologian, I think there's those voices that have to be at the table. But I'm pleased at the recent emphasis upon what the sciences might tell us about these things that at least are related to love, if not directly pertaining to love.
What studies stand out to you? I'm fascinated by, for instance, the psychological research on emotion regulation and how people who are more well-suited to control their emotions or find themselves with the inability to control their emotions, how that affects their ability to then sort of transfer that toward other people as well. What is helpful for the average person to know when it comes to filtering a lot of that research?
Yeah.
Pulling out the data that is suggestive, for instance, of practices or intervention studies to attempt to show positive correlations with, I mean, positive psychology is full of this, you know, gratitude and overall well-being, or, you know, certain attachment styles of relationship and promoting, you know, like a more loving relationship between, you know, like the love relationship between parents and children early on in life, that transferring to love relationships later in life.
I think if I were to summarize what I think are some of the insights that science generally is giving us about love, so there's some things that sort of stand out to me. One is that we sometimes think about love as a disembodied kind of act. And I think one of the things that the sciences, generally speaking, are telling us is that our bodies really do place certain kinds of constraints on what we think in terms of love, what we are capable of loving. For instance, there's been a lot of work done on those who have damaged frontal cortex and the brain sort of difficulties because of, you know, maybe being born with deformities or having accidents or whatever. And those folks seem not to have the capacities for empathy that most other people do. Or people who have been raised in very difficult families in which they've not been given the kind of care from parents that they ought to be given. Those folks have a more difficult time expressing what the rest of us think are typical acts of love. And I think that's important because we oftentimes want to judge others based upon what we think is the right thing and what we're capable of and what the, quote, normal person is capable of. But we need to be, we need to open ourselves up to the possibility that what some people are capable of is different than others because of their bodies, because of their histories, because of the communities they're a part of.
Which all the more kind of turns us towards those nuances of shalom. Those,
I totally agree.
Those details that are easily forgotten, but when they're grouped and when they're repeated, just have an enormous effect on an individual.
Exactly. And I think also, you know, there's some passages of scripture that talk about judge not lest you be judged. And those can be interpreted in ways that make you think that you're not supposed to evaluate anything in the world. And I'm not saying that, but I think they do point us to the notion that we need to be generous in our interpretations of others and we need to try to understand them well.
Yeah, that's what some people just call charity. Just
exactly.
Be charitable.
Exactly. A charitable interpretation. I think also, strangely enough, the sciences, and here I'm just painting with broad strokes.
Of course, yeah.
The sciences are pushing us to understand the importance of ecclesiology. And that is that what we do in community really does matter in shaping who we are. The habits that we have individually and as groups, but also the kinds of ways we look at reality and the capacities to overcome at least some of the constraints and incapacities from our past. Ecclesiology really does matter because it says we as a group can act and function in ways that can help us overcome some of the difficulties that we've brought along from the past, whether it's from our environment or our home life or past relationships. And even, strangely enough, even overcoming some of the disabilities we have physically. You know, there's studies showing that some of the neural pathways that we have developed over time can change because we are part of different communities and different practices. And it's not, I don't want to paint a picture that sounds like we can change our bodies entirely, but I think there's more what we say in the sciences, plasticity involved. There's more possibility for nuanced change than what some people may have thought previously.
It sort of suggests an agency to love.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
That there's some substantive property of love that has a molding or a transforming or a changing presence to an environment. How do you connect that to, I guess, the commands of Jesus in the love commands, love of God, loving neighbor as self? We receive those in a tradition sort of and read them as commands, but then we see that there's, and I think this is what I'm hearing about, the data of science is bringing to us that there are these benefits. You know, that's what positive psychology is suggesting. Yeah. Again, like pro-social behavior, positivity. And so there's this fascinating, maybe unsurprising idea that love actually does work.
I think it does.
It's not just a command.
I think oftentimes the lover receives benefit from his or her own loving. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it happens all the time. Sometimes love is self-sacrificial and we give up some goods to ourselves. But often, Jesus' words in the Gospels where he says, give and it will be given unto you, pressed down, shaken together, and be overflowing, will be placed in your lap, for the measure you give will be the measure you receive. I think there's something to that saying that says that what's good for the giver is all, or good for the receiver is also good for the giver.
I think there are probably great philosophical and theological distinctions to be made here, but I think like maybe perhaps obedience and maybe pleasure or obedience and benefit. Like there's this obedience to the love commands, but then there's also this deep benefit that the obedient person receives in obeying and in exploring and living into those commands. It becomes a way of flourishing, not merely obedience.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I hear in the sort of, it's good for the giver too.
Yeah. You know, my view when it comes to the question of obedience is that the Christian traditions that have emphasized what we in philosophy call a deontological notion of ethics, that is, you do it because it's right, those traditions have often overlooked what I think is what we're talking about here, and that is that there's real benefits to doing what is right. And I think one of the positives of love theology is that it can replace this notion that obedience is our primary response to God to this idea that a relationship of love is our primary response, in which obedience is just one facet, but not the dominant one.
Mm-hmm.
Let me illustrate it with this. I'm a Princess Bride fan, one of my favorite movies of all time.
Now you're speaking my language.
And the opening part of Princess Bride.
Farm Boy.
Farm Boy's out there, and Buttercup is saying to Farm Boy, you know, do this, do that.
Fetch me that picture.
And he's saying to her, as you wish. And then the narrator says something like, and then one day Buttercup understood that every time he was saying, as you wish, he was really saying, I love you.
As you wish.
And that is a way to illustrate how obedience is all of a sudden a person who thinks, well, I'm just supposed to obey God, when they start realizing that what's even deeper than obedience is this love relationship, in which not only can we benefit from this relationship, but in my theology, God can even benefit, that there's well-being that extends beyond the creaturely realm to the divine realm. And in that way of thinking about reality, then obedience is just one aspect, but not the primary one.
You can die too, for all I care.
Oh. As you wish.
Oh, my sweet Wesley, what have I done?
Maybe there's something we could focus on in here, the idea of loving God.
Yeah.
Now, this might be a pathology itself, but the maybe rampant idea that God does not benefit from my loving him. It's sheerly an obedience relationship, and it's just what I owe him.
That's the dominant view in the Christian tradition itself, thanks to some of the major thinkers in the Christian tradition. Augustine would be my classic example.
Mm-hmm.
Augustine thought that God was complete, total, didn't change one iota, wasn't affected one iota, and so that God's love was always giving and never receiving. And I think that's a poor view of love and a poor view of God. I think God is always giving love, but also receiving our responses, and that when we respond well to God's first actions in our life, moment by moment, God actually benefits, not just other creatures. And that this activity that we do in our lives can make a difference ultimately, not just for us and the world, but also for God.
There's a big word associated with this, right? Impassibility.
Right, yeah. I think God is passible, to use that language. I think God is affected. I think God's a real giver and receiver. I think God's the living Lord of history, and our actions really do make a difference to God. The way I read Scripture, I think Scripture supports that pretty strongly.
There's a connection in the word of passible to passion and suffering.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the story of the incarnation is,
exactly.
The passion of Christ.
Yes.
How does that become a model for the kind of loving through suffering that seems so woven into the human story?
Yeah. Let me first talk about suffering and make a distinction. in everyday language, we think of suffering as enduring pain. And while I think God does endure pain, and Jesus is a great example of that, in the classic tradition, suffering basically just means being affected by others. And that could be painful or pleasure. So it means being in a giving and receiving kind of relationship. In terms of our relationship with others, sometimes I think we've thought that people who really love well are always giving and never really being involved. And so today we've come to see that those people who just give their money to causes but who don't invest themselves aren't really loving to the degree that we think that they ought to be. And so, you know, I'm one of these people who tries to help those in need in various places in the world. And there's something about being invested in their actual lives in which they make an influence on me and they actually benefit me that goes so much further than me writing a check and sending it there. And I think we've oftentimes thought of God as the great check writer in the sky, not the God who is intimately involved and whose own experience can be positively or negatively affected by how we respond to God's love in our lives.
I think the example that you raise with writing a check and doing your duty, so to speak, as a giver, it feels noble. It feels distant. It feels like you are this beneficent presence to a world in need. And yet that's so easy. And you wonder just if love really does require some sort of localized relationship, an awareness of one another, an acquaintance, sort of knowing between the people involved. It's going to be demanding in a different way than just writing a check.
And I don't think you can love well unless you know well the circumstances. And in order to know well the circumstances, you have to be involved. You have to be vulnerable. You have to be in the midst of it. You know, if I'm dating someone and I send them roses, thinking I'm doing a kind and loving thing, but I don't take the time to find out that she's allergic to roses, then what my motives were good, but the consequences end up being negative. But if you're in that kind of relationship where you get to know the other person and you're affected by them and you're vulnerable, then the possibility that your love motives can be truly effective increases greatly. I think in our society, we have kind of looked down at our noses at those who are vulnerable, those who are affected by others because we think, well, they're going to be wishy-washy. They're just going to go with whatever the impulse, whatever the pull is, wherever the power is. But I think real love is involved in those relationships and is influenced, and yet, no matter what happens, acts for the good of those involved. Unfortunately, we've thought of God, I think, as the one who is invulnerable, who isn't affected by others, because we've rightly wanted to have a notion of God who can't go from being loving to unloving, can't go from being beneficent to being mean. But what we've missed out is the idea that God's character can stay unchanging and immutable and love, and yet God can be vulnerable, suffering in the midst of relationship, and then understand well what true effective love means in any particular situation toward any particular creature. Hmm. That, I think, that's one of the keys in my mind in understanding divine love well. God's character is unchangingly loving, but God's experience is moment by moment giving and receiving vulnerability.
That relationship of vulnerability is so apparent in the concept of enemy love.
Hmm.
And even this is seen in a tradition of nonviolence, where the oppressed, in loving their oppressors, open themselves again in vulnerability, standing up, saying no, but doing so peacefully and yet so vulnerably, knowing that violence can come from it. There's this posture of deep and profound vulnerability that seems to follow from this concept of loving one's enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it exposes the lover in that case.
Definitely. They're more vulnerable. And the reason someone calls you an enemy is because that person doesn't like something about you. And in some way, whether it's physical or some other way, they feel justified in harming you. And for you not to harm in return and to stay engaged in that relationship in a vulnerable way, that's huge.
Standing up, saying no, but doing so peacefully and yet so vulnerably, mm-hmm. knowing that violence can come from it. There's this posture of deep and profound vulnerability that seems to follow from this concept of loving one's enemy, mm-hmm. because it exposes the lover in that case.
Definitely. They're more vulnerable. And the reason someone calls you an enemy is because that person doesn't like something about you. And in some way, whether it's physical or some other way, they feel justified in harming you. And for you not to harm in return and to stay engaged in that relationship in a vulnerable way, that's huge. So I'm a risk taker, but even for me to see how deep the pain can go, I can become afraid sometimes. And I'm tempted not to be vulnerable, not to give charitable interpretations, not to live the love of Christ that I think I ought to live. And so that's one of the things I've learned is how powerful fear can be.
And yet love casts out fear.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting. You might think that the countervailing force to fear is bravery and strength and courage and some show of force.
Yeah.
And yet we learn it's love.
Yeah, definitely love. And I think... Yeah.
It just, it articulates a perhaps again, like the radical nature of the Christian ethic.
I think you're right. You know, most people, when they think, if I'm going to be afraid, then what I should do is barricade myself, get more locks for my house, get an alarm system, or socially protect myself by only having friends and those who will say good things to me. But in the end, that kind
become
of,
less vulnerable.
Become less vulnerable, exactly. In the end, it just narrows. It puts a stranglehold on the abundant life that I think Jesus wants us to live, because it doesn't open you up to the fruitfulness that comes from so many other diverse and wide-ranging experiences and people.
Tom, this has been awesome.
Oh, I've enjoyed it too. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time and your work and visiting.
Oh, thanks.
The center and,
I'm honored that you've invited me and I enjoy it.
That's it for this episode. I know it was a bit long, but well. My mama said you can't hurry love. Thanks for listening. Table Audio is hosted by me, Evan Rosa, and is produced by the Biola University Center for Christian Thought, which is sponsored by generous grants from the John Templeton Foundation, Templeton Religion Trust, and the Blankenmeyer Foundation. Theme music is by The Brilliance. Production and engineering by the Narrativo Group. More info at narrativogroup.com. Edited and mixed by TJ Hester. To subscribe to The Table Audio, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what we're up to and you want to support more of this kind of thing, you can do two things. First, tell your friends and share this episode in an email or social media or break the ice with a new pal. And second, give us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. These things really help. On Twitter, you can follow me at Evan Subrosa, and you can follow the Center for Christian Thought at BiolaCCT or visit our website, cct.biola.edu.